The Gemara says that in the Yesod, foundation of the part of the Torah which deals with mitzvot that affect a man and his fellow man, it's called Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, where the Torah says you're supposed to treat your fellow man with respect, dignity, with consideration, with kindness. You're not supposed to fool him or cheat him or steal from him. There's one mitzvah that is outstanding and above all. That is the mitzvah being done l'kaf sechut, to judge a person truly good. If in doubt, judge a person to the good. You see a person doing something, and it may be the right thing, or it may look like the wrong thing, and there is a possibility he's doing what's right, but it appears to be wrong. In any event, if you are in doubt, judge him to zechut. Down lekaf zechut. Zechut means to the right side. Not lekaf chov, to the guilty side. This is an outstanding mitzvah. Generally, the Gemara says that a person who does that, whose habit is to judge all people to the good, in heaven, they always return measure for measure. So whatever this person himself does, in heaven they say, let's judge him for the good. Even though heaven has no doubts, they know this person's real intentions, still they say, as long as there's a possibility of weighing his action towards slightly towards the good side, do it that way, because the way he deals with his fellow man, that's how he's to be dealt with. To what extent does this rule apply? The Gemara tells us two cases, two different cases, but very enlightening. One case, a man who lived in the Galil, and he came down, Galil Ha'elyon. The Galilee has the Upper Galilee, the Lower Galilee. Like, for instance, Safed, the Upper Galilee, that's on a mountain. The Lower Galilee is Tiberias, in that vicinity. A man who lived in the Upper Galilee, who was not wealthy, he came down to the Lower Galilee to work. He hired himself out as a worker by a rich man. This was, of course, not in the Lower Galilee, as he went further down to the south. But he worked there for 3 years' time. At least 3 years' time, of course, he had room and board. But he didn't work for the sake of room and board, he worked for the sake of his pay. After 3 years, he decided to return to his home with all his wages. The time for the completion, the termination of his work, was the day before Yom Kippur, end of Yom Kippur. On that day is a time when each person takes an accounting of himself and sees that he pays off all his debts and so on. So the worker came to the master, and he said to him, give me my wages. I must go back to my wife and children. I must provide for them. So please pay me what you owe. The owner said, this master said, I'm sorry, but I have no money. That means I have no cash on hand. I can't pay you now. So this worker said, well, in that case, give me fruit. You have fields. Give me some fruit for the amount of the wages. The fruit I could take with me, I could sell it. The owner said, I'm sorry, I have no fruit either. So he said, well, give me a parcel of land that will amount to the sum. The owner said, I have no land either. He said, give me an animal, cow, steer. He said, I don't have any. So he said, then give me something that I can handle, like give me some white goods, quilts, blankets, sheets, pillowcases, anything. So he said, I'm sorry, I have nothing. This man was very sad. He took his little knapsack and he returned home. Went back to his house without any wages at all. After the holiday, after Sukkot, the owner took this man's wages with him, the exact amount of wages he had earned. He also filled three mules, one with the best type of food, and one with loaded with drinks, and one with expensive type of clothing. He went to this poor man's house, to the worker's house. The worker invited him in. He sat there for a meal without telling him anything. He invited him in, told him to sit down for a meal. After the meal was over, the owner gave him the wages plus this extra bonus. Then the owner turned to this poor man and said to him, I want to ask you a few questions. When I told you that I have no money at all, you asked me for your wages. I said, I have no cash at all. Knowing that I'm a wealthy man, what did you think of me then? What did you suspect me of? The worker said, truthfully, I thought probably, most probably, you had just at that moment invested in some unusual buy, a chance to buy a certain kind of goods at an unusual price, and you put all your ready cash into it. He said, well, when you ask me for an animal, and I said, I have no animals at all. You know my fields are filled with animals. What did you suspect me of then? He said, I figured perhaps that you had rented out all your animals to others. They were rented, they're not yours at the time. When you rent something, you lease something, you're not the owner anymore until it leases up. He said, all right, well, then you asked me for a parcel of land. And I said, I haven't. Why did you suspect me of then? He said, I thought for sure, too, that you had leased your land to someone else to work the fields then you would divide the profits. He said, when you ask me for fruit, why do you suspect me of that? I said, I have no fruit. He said, well, I figured perhaps that you had not yet taken off ma'asir. Fruit is considered forbidden fruit until you take off a tenth and give it to the Kohen. So perhaps you hadn't taken ma'asir off yet, and therefore you couldn't give it to me. It's forbidden. He said, when you ask me for any items I have in the house at all, what did you suspect me of when I said I have nothing in the house? He said, well, I thought perhaps you had at that moment said that you were making Hekdesh, Kodesh. You declared all your property at home as holy to Hashem by giving it to charity. So the owner said, he swore by all that is holy, exactly as you thought in your mind, that's exactly what happened to me. Everything you said would happen to me, I couldn't get myself to say it to you because it seemed unbelievable. I felt very badly. At that moment, I had declared all my property as holy to Hashem because of my son, who I felt was not learning enough Torah. I didn't want him to inherit me. My son was Hurkinus. Of course, the Gemara, it's a different story. This is a famous story in the Gemara, showing how these famous people in the Gemara are related to these stories that pertain to law. This was the father of Rabbi Hurkinus, who was one of the greatest rabbis in the Gemara, who the father thought he wasn't learning, and then he found that he was hiddenly a great tzaddik. But at the time, he had declared his property Kodesh. He found out, of course, later that it was an error, and it was voided. So he said, at the time, I had declared my property all Kodesh, and I had nothing to give to you. Now, because you had judged me to the good side as a chut, I bless you that Hashem should always judge you for Zechut, too. Now, this is one case. Of course, this is an unusual case. We say about judging a person as Zechut, it doesn't cost you anything if you see someone doing something that's questionable, and you say, well, I'll judge him for Zechut. It's no expense to you. Here, the extent of judging the Kaf Zechut, even where the worker was losing so much by it, appeared to be losing so much, and was so heartbroken after working 3 years, still he held nothing in his heart against the master, the owner, because he judged the Kaf Zechut. The second case, the case of Rabbi Yehoshua, one of the chief rabbis of the Gemara, he was called the wisest of all Jews, and this was a case where the Chachamim needed something from the governess, like the queen of that kingdom. And in order to get this favor from her, they said which one of the Jews would be able to persuade her to give the Jews this favor. They decided upon Rabbi Yehoshua, who was the cleverest of all. Rabbi Yehoshua went together with his students, but he came to the house of this matron, this woman. When he got to the door, he took off his tefillin when he was 4 or 8 feet away. He came to the door, he entered, and he closed the door, he locked the door behind him. That means he was left alone there with her. Then, when he came out, he didn't speak to his students, he first went to the mikveh. Then, when he came back, he said to the students, tell me, when you saw me take off my tefillin, what did you suspect me of? They said, simple, we thought for sure you cannot bring tefillin into a place of tumah. This woman was not Jewish in a place of tumah. He said, fine, that's simple. But when you saw me lock the door behind me, what did you suspect me of then? They said, we figured you had to speak something very privately. It's a matter pertaining to the kingdom. And the Gemara warns against having ears eavesdrop. As the Gemara says, the walls have ears. Be careful to see that nobody hears, because you never can tell who might overhear and spread the word in the wrong place. He said, when I came out and I went to the mikveh, this can only mean after being with a woman. What did you suspect me of then? They said, we figured perhaps that something of her might have touched your clothes from a distance. And anything that has to do with the goyim is tameh, makes you consider yourself tameh. Not legally, but one of those that particular wants to be completely pure, he goes to the mikveh. That's all we thought. He said, exactly as you said, so was the case. Just as you have judged me for the good for Zechut, so may Hashem always judge you for Zechut. The second case, of course, is a little different, because the Gemara warns there is a big difference. We mentioned before that when you see a person doing something and there is a doubt, there's a possibility of judging him in a way that would condemn him or a way that would condone his action, you must judge him to the good. In the case of a person's rabbi, the Gemara says that when you see him doing something which is definitely bad, definitely a guilty act, you still have to judge him for the good, even though there's no question about the act being a wrong one. You have to say that certainly he did something wrong, but immediately afterwards, without any question or doubt, he did teshuva bad. And in doing teshuva bad, the act was erased as though it didn't exist. And therefore, in your eyes, it should be as though it did not exist at all. You cannot keep in your mind a bad thought about the rabbi after, immediately after it was done. This must be in a positive sense, not in a sense of doubt. A person who suspects, in general, in a case of doubt, if he suspects the rabbi of doing something wrong, the Gemara says this is as though he suspects. So great a sin it is. But in all cases, regardless of who the person is, a Jew should accustom himself to look at the better side at all times, judge every Jew for the good, no matter what happens, and in that case, he will find himself, find favor in the eyes of heaven. We mentioned many times the case of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Barditchev Zal, who was known as the Melitz Yosher, the Ohev Yisrael. He was the one who showed such a deep love for Jews. He became famous to the point that thousands of stories are told about him. And if he'd see a person committing a crime, open sin, he would never think badly of the Jew. There are stories told that he saw a person eating a Yom Kippur. And he said to him, "You're not committing a sin, I'm sure. I never suspect, perish the thought that you're breaking Kippur. Undoubtedly, you must have forgotten that it's Kippur." Certainly, this person he was speaking to was a very wicked Jew, very spiteful. So he mocked this great rabbi, and he said, "Oh no." He said he knows it's Kippur, and he's still eating. He was undaunted, and he said, "Of course, you know it's Kippur, but I know why you're still eating, because you're probably sick. And the doctor said if you don't eat, then this might be injurious to your health, it might be a peril to your life. Therefore, you are allowed to eat." This man said, "No, he's as healthy as a horse. Still eating." He said, "Well," he walked away and he said, "Well, it's still very nice." He said, "Hashem, your Jews are remarkable people. They have such good qualities. And here's a man who under no conditions will tell a lie. Look at the truth of the Jew. He won't lie for anything." In other words, he'd find the silver lining in everything. He'd look only for the good. He would never come back with a bad report about a Jew, no matter what. This, of course, is an extreme case. But in all cases, he was known to interpret a person's actions for the good. If we cannot reach his level in that, his madriga, at least we must try, for the sake of fulfilling the desire of Hashem, that every Jew should regard his fellow Jew as superior to himself. The Ramban. The Ramban lived in a time of the Ramban, only he was known as the Mikubal, he learned Kabbalah. The Ramban writes in a letter to his son that always consider the person you're speaking to as better than you. If you are 1,000 times more learned than he is, a bigger chacham, a more religious, consider him still better than you, because if you commit a small sin, you're held responsible. If he commits a big sin, he might be excused for it. He doesn't know any better. And surely, if he knows how to learn better than you, you should surely consider him superior. That no matter who you speak to, always consider yourself on a lower level than they are. This will give you the anivut, the modesty, the humility that will bring you to every type of kiddusha of holiness. But above all, the main item in dealing with a fellow Jew is this mitzvah of being dan lekaf sechut. Rabbeinu Zal adds a very vital point, a point that is overlooked by so many. Rabbeinu Zal brought it up. Rabbeinu Zal says that if you are dan erasha, to the good side, what's going to happen? This rasha will be taken back so much by it. He'll say, "Here, he did something so wrong, and instead of being condemned for it, the Jew sympathizes with him and says, 'You're probably a good person, you're not doing wrong.' He's consoling him. The rasha will feel embarrassed, and he will do teshuva automatically. Plus the fact that by seeing the good side of the rasha, you'll find he's not really that bad. There's a reason for what he's doing, and he has good points about him, so that he's not the wicked person you thought he is." Benazal says, note, that this same action could be used within a person himself. Many times a person feels so dejected, as the Shalom, that he says, "I've fallen to such a low madriga, low level. I don't see any hope for myself because I have so many bad deeds that I do. When I finally do something that's good, it's so tainted and so weak and so bad that even that good deed I do is no good. Here I go and put on tefillin. Tefillin is considered the crown of Hashem. It's rather so great, which luckier, better off I am than those Jews who don't put on tefillin. When I think of it, I say, what's the use? I put on tefillin without kavanah. I rush and put them on without respect for the holiness of tefillin. So even when I do mitzvah, it's no good. And this can bring a person down to a low level of sadness, dejection. Chazal says that a person should use this power of dalekaf zechut for himself. Seek the good points within himself. And when you find that good point, dwell on it until you feel a degree of simcha, of happiness within yourself, and you'll find that you are being elevated. No longer are you an asha, but you are on the level of tzaddik. This way you'll drag yourself out of this mire, and you'll begin to serve Hashem with much more intensity, with much more happiness. So a person must be dan lekaf zechut, not just his fellow Jew, but even himself too. So that by doing that, you'll take that person or yourself out of the madriga of Rasha into the madriga of tzaddik. The Gemara says that there are many mitzvot that we do today which we perform happily. There's a certain simcha about it. And others that simcha is lacking. What is the reason for it? For example, the mitzvah of a brit milah. Brit milah in general is accepted as a very happy occasion. First place, a man has a son, that alone is already something to be happy about. He celebrates. Secondly, the brit milah is something that's considered a festive occasion where people come. There's an aura of elation there, simcha. We have a case of marriage, which is simcha. It should be simcha. It should be happier than a brit milah. Yet we find that marriage is never as happy as a brit milah. In a brit milah, no arguments arise. Everyone is happy at the time. At marriage, there's always arguments. The Yehuda says there cannot be a marriage without a battle first between the consuegos, bride side, the groom side. This one says they want a wedding this way, this one wants the other way, this one wants the bride's parents to give more money towards the wedding, this one wants the other side to give more money. There's always the arguments about money. Whatever the ketubah, the marriage contract, is written, how much to write down, four fives or five fives, so much money in the ketubah, marriage contract, there's always a battle, always a dispute over it. Why is the simcha brit milah so pure and filled with simcha? Why is the marriage ceremony, that is, that which precedes the marriage ceremony, when it comes to the chuppah, finally they're all happy. Until they get to it, they have to get over the hurdle of this controversy, dispute, and sometimes brings out the worst in a person. The reason is that it's the way the mitzvah was accepted originally. Mitzvah brit milah was accepted with happiness, as King David says in David, Ses anochi al imratecha, that very happy about this mitzvah, which came through the word of Hashem, the first mitzvah that Hashem gave to Abraham Avinu, and I feel simcha over it. It was accepted with simcha by Abraham Avinu too. So originally it was accepted with simcha, and therefore this simcha remained for ages. The law of marriage, which meant that there is a restriction. No longer can the bride seek other suitors, no longer can the husband go out and seek others, or no longer can the husband marry certain people. Once he marries this bride, then there are certain women that now he is forbidden to marry. Anyone related to the bride now is forbidden for him. So when this mitzvah was given, the Chumash HaTorah tells us that the Jews cried over it. They were sad over this mitzvah, and because it was accepted, the sadness, there remained this controversy, this ill feeling, till the end of time, that is, till Mashiach comes. The Yehuda assures us that there cannot be a ketubah, a marriage contract, without some kind of a battle that must take place. It's not a happy thought, and of course, knowing this is going to take place, people should prepare for it. In other words, get the right type of weapons. The best weapons are the willingness to compromise, to give in, and to make peace. Naturally, every rule has its exceptions. There are some rare cases where it goes through without any dispute, without any argument. But in those cases, too, hiddenly, if it doesn't come out in the open, then it might be in feelings alone. This is a fact that must be experienced. And the Torah tells us that there is no such thing as a ketubah without an argument or some kind of that ill feeling. We have to believe that we know that it's there. Some people are too polite to bring it out openly, but they have a resentment within them. But that exists in every case. The exceptional cases are where it doesn't come out too much in the open, or possibly even at all in the open. The average case, of course, is where there are open arguments that reach a heated degree at many times. There have been cases where, by the way, the match was broken just before the wedding ceremony because of these arguments. The reason for this is the origin of the way the mitzvah was accepted in the first place. The Gemara tells us there's a pasuk in the Torah which says, Ze keli v'anvehu. This is in the Shirat Hayam. We say it as Yashir every day. Ze keli, this is Hashem. V'anvehu means that I will beautify him. The Gemara says, how do you beautify Hashem? What is meant by beautifying Hashem? The Gemara says, beautify the mitzvot of Hashem. Whatever mitzvah Hashem gives you, beautify it. In other words, Hashem tells you there's a mitzvah to build a sukkah. You might buy a sukkah, build one of the cheapest type of wood, plywood, or remnants, put up the cheapest type of sukkah, and it's still kasher. But this is a mitzvah, beautify it. Spend extra money on it, because that is fulfilling mitzvah, beautifying the word of Hashem. Well, the Torah tells you to get an etrog, a lulav. You can buy a kosher one for $10, you can buy a kosher one for $30. Whatever it is, the more money you spend for it, it is not wasted. You are fulfilling the mitzvah of beautifying the name and the word of Hashem. Torah says you should wear tzitzit, wear tefillin. There are various types, all are kasher to a certain degree. The more you spend for it, the greater the mitzvah. Torah says mezuzah. You can have the same. Sefer Torah. The writing can be one that's kasher, yet cheap, just passable. You can get one that's very expensive, written by a great tzaddik. The more that is spent, the richer the reward, because of the fact that if you show your anxiety to beautify the word of Hashem, so will Hashem in turn beautify your home and your life. Another rabbi says, there's another interpretation for this word. Ze keli, this is my Hashem, v'anvehu. Nave comes to the word na'eh, beautify. But the anvehu is a combination of two words. V'anvehu, v'ani, v'hu. I and he. This means, this is my Hashem, I shall try to emulate, to copy Hashem, to be like him. I will be like Hashem. How? We know that Hashem possesses the traits of mercy, kindness. Just as Hashem is kind, pitiful, compassionate, forgiving, so too should a Jew follow the lesson that Hashem teaches us, these qualities, follow these qualities of Hashem, also to be kind and considerate of others. With this, he is fulfilling the mitzvah of Ze Keli V'Anvehu, to resemble Hashem's action. The Gemara tells us something which requires a clarification. It's very sad that this clarification is not found more within the Gemara itself. In other words, it's sadly unknown to most people. We would skip this statement, except for the fact that we are fortunate in having the information clarified, therefore we can't say it openly. The wording of the Gemara is that when the sin of eating from the tree of wisdom was committed, how was it done? The Nachash, the serpent, came to Chava, persuaded her to eat from this fruit, and then she gave from this fruit to Adam. The sin was completed, and the world was plunged into an era of death. The angel of death came to the world. Yemena says, when the serpent came to persuade Chava, it was not just making her eat from the tree of wisdom, but he also seduced her and injected into her this tameh seed, and this seed remained, meaning that any child born from her contained part of this tum'ah. The tum'ah is called zohamah, a very evil tum'ah that came from this serpent. Any people born, later generations, had this evil within them, this tum'ah. And this remained until the Jews stood at Mount Sinai. They stood at Mount Sinai, then they were released from this tumah. They were cleared of it, there was no more tumah left. Another rabbi says that this tumah was removed earlier than that. Part of it was removed by Avraham Avinu. He gave birth to Ishmael and to Yitzchak. The evil left him, the form of Ishmael. Yitzchak came out pure. To a degree, it still wasn't that purified. Yitzchak Avinu gave birth to Yaakov and Esav. Again, major part of this Tumah, that is the balance of the Tumah, came out in Esav, Yaakov came out clear. Proof is that Yaakov gave birth to 12 tribes of Israel, 12 tribes of Hashem. So that we see then that it was so pure, there was nothing left of the Tumah of the Nechash, of the serpent. From then on, the Jews of Bnei Yisrael, all holy. This is the debate between these two rabbis. Now, Bnei Kadosh Rizal says that woe is to that person who accepts these words literally, Chas V'Shalom. Not because of the fact that we are stating something that is so low about Chaveh, who is the creation of Hashem. Aside from that, that's not the point. But the Rizal says, woe is to that person, because this would be the form of idiocy, idiotic, to think that at that time, when the serpent was so advanced, and they were in heaven, get it, and that this could be taken literally, then there was any thought of seducing or anything physical attached to it. There was nothing at all physical involved. This injection of the seed did not mean physical. It meant spiritually, just as when a person, Chas V'Shalom, speaks to a rasha, or speaks to a philosopher, he learns this philosophy, he absorbs the philosophy from this rasha, that goes into his mind, becomes part of his way of thinking, Chas V'Shalom, and it's very difficult for him to clear his mind from that afterwards. His faith is, by me, not affected. That's why we say, Ben Israel stresses, all the greats that he came in the past stressed, to avoid at all costs this poison of learning philosophy or having discussions with philosophers. Even if you think you can defeat them in a debate, still you stand to lose, because just hearing their words alone will inject some of this poison into your mind. And this is what's meant by the seed that was injected into Chava by this serpent. This poisonous seed of kefirah, of atheism. The serpent taught atheism. Chas V'Shalom, not to listen to the word of Hashem, to disavow, to rebel against the command of Hashem not to eat from the tree of wisdom. This was an act of atheism. And this idea he injected into Chava, and because she had it within her spirit, therefore children born afterwards had this too, till it was purified. This, though, the Zohar HaKadosh says too, that not to have waited until Mount Sinai to get rid of it, but she got rid of it with the birth of Cain. This seed was what produced Cain, spiritual seed that produced part of Cain, the first son, and because the spiritual seed was such that it contained the ideas of the serpent was a killer, the angel of death. This is what brought about the murderous instinct in Cain to kill his brother. But there too, Zohar HaKadosh stresses that this was not a physical act, Chas V'Shalom. This was a spiritual act, or an oral act, which affected the spirit. And this can be hereditary, Chas V'Shalom. A person whose mind is bad, mind of a rasha, could hand that over to his children, Chas V'Shalom. Of course, every child is given free choice. If he inherits these traits, then he starts off wrong right there. He starts off with difficulty. That's why the stress is put so strongly on avoiding any contact with the modern day serpents, who are the philosophers who inject this poison into anyone they meet. Baruch Hashem that we was oche to learn the words of the Rabbeinu Zal, who warned us against that. We avoid speaking to or reading the books written by them. We have, Baruch Hashem, enough Sefarim of Kiddusha, written by the Tzadikim of all generations. One final item. The Gemara says that there are two cities. In one city, the wine of that city is very good. It's excellent. It's superior to any other wine. In another city, the waters are like mountain waters. They draw a person to them. They're of excellent quality, far superior to any other place. Yehuda says that the 10 lost tribes were destroyed by the wine of that city of Prugita and the water of Diumsit. Because this wine and waters draw a person to them, And this brings out physical desires, which automatically take a person away from spiritual value. They stop the study after that. They go for the physical pleasures. This brings them down to a point where they lose out on their religion. Chas v'shalom, that's what happened to the 10 lost tribes. And the Gemara says, in Pirkei Avot, it says that the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had 5 students. Now, mind you, this is to how far, this, what extent this goes. The first student was Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol. Eliezer HaGadol was the rabbi of Rabbi Akiva. So great was he, superior to all of the rabbis at his time, and despite the fact that he was not the Nasi, chief rabbi was Rabbi Gamliel. This was one student. Another was Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya, who was called the Hakim HaDiyudai, the wisest of all the Jews, cleverness. The fifth one was Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. And the Mishneh Pirkei Avot says that putting them on a scale, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would put them on a scale for all the students, plus all the rabbis of the Jews. And he said, take them all combined and take Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the last one alone, put him on the opposite side of the scale, he would outweigh all of them in knowledge. So superior was he. Others say, there's a debate, others say that it was Rabbi Elazar ben Gadol he said it about. In any event, this statement is made in Pirkei Avot. Now the Gemara says, this great Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, who's known also by his pseudonym Rabbi Nehorai. Nehorai means the great light, tremendous light, because he brought this great light to the Jews with his Torah. He traveled to this city where they had this special superior type of water, and staying there, he was drawn by this. Great as he was drawn into it to a point where he stopped studying Torah and he forgot his learning. Completely forgot what he had learned. Now, when he came back, he returned from that place. He'd been there for quite a while. Came back to the yeshiva. He went to read, not Gemara, not Tef, but Chumash. Just to read the words. The first mitzvah in the Torah is HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem. That is the first mitzvah that Hashem told the Jews when he left Egypt. This month of Nisan, the month of Pesach, the law of Pesach. The first words are HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem. This month is for you. Reading those three words, he said, HaChodesh Haya Liban. In other words, a mistake in every one of the three words. Instead of HaChodesh this month, HaChodesh, HaChodesh, which means death. Instead of HaZeh this, he read Haya was. Instead of Lachem for you, he said Liban, their heart. The whole sentence was changed. HaChodesh Haya Liban, their heart was made deaf. It couldn't hear. We say the heart hears, it means the heart understands. The heart became deafened. So far that he lost his learning. The Gemara says that the rabbis had pity on him, they prayed for him, and his knowledge came back to him. Therefore, it says in Pirkei Avot, using his pseudonym, it says that Rabbi Nehorai says, leave your home, go to a place to study Torah, and never be sure of yourself. Always continue to study Torah. Never say that you can rely upon others for it. This he stressed afterwards, how dangerous it is for a person to stop the study of Torah. This is what the Gemara says here, but it would pay to examine these words. Now, there is naturally a message in this. He picked those three words. How come he changed the words around to exactly, you miss a letter, it comes out to a word which has no meaning. Or if it comes out to a word that has a meaning, then it wouldn't have the three words match so exactly with a message in them. Plus, how come just these three letters? If we examine it carefully, the Riyah Kadosh says, HaChodesh, he changed the Dalet to Erej, HaChodesh. The one that he changed was to Erej. HaZeh, he changed to Haya, Erej and then Yud. Then, Lachem, he changed to Libam. That's Erej, Yud, Bet. Erej, Yud, Bet is Riv, which means Machloket. Machloket, debate, Safek, doubt. Plus the fact that Ezal says that there are Erej, Yud, Bet is 212. There are 212 groups of evil angels. They work under the Satan. And this meant that the person who leaves Torah is attacked by these 212 evil groups. It seems to me, what we have learned many times about the importance of learning Torah, how to learn Torah, where to study Torah, there's another message involved here. The difference between one who has the heart that hears, accepts, and absorbs. And one who doesn't is one who learns by himself. And Jimenez says, one who learns by himself, then it's cherev el abadim. He deserves the sword. He deserves to be destroyed because his learning is worthless. One who learns with another, especially one who learns from a rabbi, that person is successful in Torah. Now this, Rav ben Anach warned when he said to leave Torah, above all, to leave a rabbi, three letters that he hid in these words are Rej, Bet, Yud, Rabbi. He says, without, when the Rabbi is missing, instead of having the Torah shine forth, first mitzvah, Chodesh Hazeh Lachem, you celebrate together the mitzvah of Pesach, you have a Chadesh Hayalibam. Because you destroyed the origin of Torah, you haven't got the rabbi, the result is that your heart becomes hardened, it fails to absorb, and there is no possible knowledge that can enter. This was the hidden message that the Elazar ben Anach gave. We cannot say, of course, that he had lost the knowledge to the point where he couldn't understand at all. Obviously, he had read, prayed,